Hello and welcome to another episode of Material Matters with Grant Gibson. The show is 4 years old now, but for listeners who might be new to all this, the idea is I speak to a designer, maker, artist or architect about a material or technique with which they're intrinsically linked and discover how it changed their lives and careers. Before we start, I'm delighted that the headline sponsor for this series of the podcast and the Material Matters Fair is Burt Frank. The company crafts beautiful lighting to order from its manufacturing base in Birmingham using traditional methods paired with the latest technology. Skilled craftsmen rely on their years of expertise and the finest quality materials to produce timeless investment pieces that will last a lifetime, going to great lengths to ensure all clients can rely on the bespoke service and a unique, beautifully engineered product. My guest this week is Henry Tadros. Henry is chairman of one of the country's most renowned furniture companies, Urquhart. Now, I don't propose to go through the firm's full history here. Suffice to say, it was founded in 1920 by Lucien Urquhartiani, but it really found its feet after the Second World War with the Windsor range, an industrial version of a traditional craft chair that is best known for its steam bending process and using a combination of elm and beech wood. Over the years, Urquhart's furniture, with its pared back but somehow very British aesthetic, has found its way into millions of homes both here and abroad. And the company has remained firmly in family hands. Henry is the fourth generation to run Urquhart, taking over from his father, Edward Tadros, last year. Henry, thank you very, very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much for having me, Grant.
It's a complete pleasure. Was that reasonably accurate?
Yes, it was.
Oh, good, good. Tell me, where are you at the moment? We're talking over Zoom. I'm guessing you found a quiet corner in your factory in Princess Risborough.
Yes, I'm hopefully in a quiet corner in the factory where we moved here in 2001. So we've always had a factory in the UK since we started in 1920.
Can we talk about that building for a moment? Because it was designed by Horden Cherry Lee at a cost of £11 million. It won a number of awards, and I remember being featured in The Observer when it was first opened. Can you describe it for listeners? Just give us a sense of where and how your furniture is produced.
Yeah, so we're out in the Chiltern Woods. It's a wonderful kind of big, open, light building. Horden Cherry Lee were students of Norman Foster when they were at college, and they definitely had some similar kind of choices when they built this building. My father really made a big decision in the late 1990s to stay in the UK. And that was a time when there was a lot of outsourcing going on. And the furniture industry in Wycombe was just getting smaller and smaller.
This is High Wycombe, where you were traditionally based, right?
Yes, yeah. So we started in High Wycombe for the first 90 years, and then we moved out to Princess Risborough. And yeah, it's a lovely, open, wide, 16,000 square meter building with windows everywhere, basically. So it's working with wood inside the woods. And that was kind of really kind of important for us to be able to have that.
I mean, talking of woods, can we get into your latest project?
Yeah.
We're recording this before Clerkenwell Design Week, where you're launching this. And I'm not absolutely sure when the episode will come out. But regardless of that, you're working with Grown in Britain, whose task, its website says, is to develop a new wood culture. And you're going to launch two of your best love designs, the Pebble Nest and the Merino Chair, out of ash. Why ash?
Yeah, it's a long journey.
Okay, well, you can tell us. We have hours.
Yeah. So ash right now, in this kind of context with Grown in Britain, is the best timber for us to be using in Britain. There's a lot of it, unfortunately, due to ash dieback. So there's a glut in the country. But at the same time, it's a really nice timber to be working with. It's a clean, yet with British ash, there's quite a wild grain to it. So we're really excited to see how it changes from our European ash that we've been using. And we've been using European ash for about the last 5 to 10 years. And before that, we were using American ash. And before that, for a very long time, we've been using elm and beech.
Yes, I was going to ask you, because I mean, historically, I think that's what many people, when they think of Urquhart, they think of elm and beech. Can we talk about the properties of the three different woods that you've talked about? How are they different to work with, I wonder?
Okay, get into the technical detail.
We can do that on this podcast, I think.
Oh, definitely. Elm and beech was the traditional timber. So out in High Wycombe, the bodgers, the single kind of craftsmen in the beech woods, which there were plentiful of them in the kind of the Chiltern areas, would cut down beech because that was the tree that they could cut down. And so that was in abundance in the area. Well, elm, they kind of use some of the different qualities, as you said. So the elm timber had, it was a wonderful, beautiful grain. My great-grandfather always used to call it the surface. it was his kind of quite oblique way of saying, this is what you had to see. And so on the chairs, on the cabinets, on the tabletops, it was always going to be elm because it just had a wonderful wild grain to it. It was a bit softer. So the beech was a very hard timber, very good for steam bending. It was very good for the framework of chairs. So we were kind of making sure that you would make the legs and underframes in beech, and then you'd have the seat being elm.
So the bits you were steam bending were beech, and then the seat, which you probably weren't having to work quite as hard, was in elm.
Yeah. Elm is a difficult timber. So a lot of what we were doing in the 40s and 50s when we were working out how to mass produce chairs effectively with the utility furniture movement was taming elm. We spent 10, 15, 20 years kind of doing that during World War II, and then kind of the years after that to really kind of work out how you can make thousands at a time.
I love that notion of taming it. And I wonder how you go about taming it.
So it's a process of kilning, really, but also a process of jointing the panels. We worked out a way how to steam kiln. Air drying the timber was the first process. It would take, I think it was a year for every inch of thickness of plank. I should also say we had a large sawmill called Latimer Sawmills out in the woods in Chilterns, where we employed up to 115 people just converting timber. So this was a very big kind of operation for us back in the 50s, up until the 80s, really. But I'll get onto that in a bit. And so the air drying timber would be the first process. And then the second process that we really kind of pioneered, what Lucien did back in the 40s, was steam kilning, where we brought the percentage of humidity down from about 30 to 12, 13% of humidity inside the timber. You flood it and then you bring it down over a matter of weeks. So it's a much more kind of consistent control of knowing what the moisture content was, and then you can bring it down.
So when you say flood it, I'm kind of guessing a bit here, but within the kiln, you steam it. And so the moisture across the timber is even. So then when it dries evenly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about the consistency and the evenness. You needed to be sure that every part of the timber was like that. So that was the first step in taming the elm. And the second step was really, if you look at our chairs or most chairs, you'll see that it's not just one plank of timber making the seat. It's jointed panels, effectively, that there's 2, 6, 8 smaller panels that are put together to make the seat. And that is because you have to get the stability. If it was one panel or two panels, like split in half, it would just warp. You could maybe, if you're a bespoke craftsman making one or two, you could work out how to make it thick enough or do something to make one chair. But if you're making thousands, or if we were looking at the process, the utility trade movement, where we made 100,000 kitchen chairs, you just have to have mass production, and you have to know that every single part will be exactly the same and will not move, because solid timber is solid. It used to be alive and it moves in any way. So it was really that process. So the jointed panels, which were cramped together on a Taylor windmill cramps, were the kind of the final part, because then we knew that we could machine it and we could get hundreds of seats that are all the same, that when our craftsmen put them together, they know that the legs will go in and it will all fit right.
The elm was tamed in that sense. I mean, obviously, talking about elm, it feels like it comes from another era. I grew up with Dutch elm disease. How did Dutch elm disease affect Urquhart?
It completely changed the company. From probably about the 40s, I think, when we bought our first batch of elm. Pre that, it was actually oak and a little bit of beech. But from the 40s to about 88 was the last time we bought any elm from Britain, from Blenheim Estate, I think it was. And Dutch elm disease came about from the 70s, and we could see it happening. It just decimated the woodlands. In 1973, we used 500,000 square feet of elm. Compared to 250,000 square feet of beech. It was just such a large amount of timber that we were using each year. And pretty much over a space of 5 to 10 years, it'd gone from the Britain. And at least in the last five years, the quality just wasn't good. So we also, you know, pride ourselves on the kind of the quality of the timber that we're using. And it gets to a point where what you can buy, there still might be enough to buy in Britain, but it's just not good enough because the disease had really taken its toll. It was interesting though as well, because elm is a hedgerow tree, so they are very visible in people's minds, because that means they're standalone trees on a ridge or in the middle of a field, so you can really see it when you drive around the south of Britain.
There used to be a village near where I lived, and it just had this one tree in the middle of the village, and it died. I mean, it's quite a dramatic thing.
Yeah, they're very long lasting. They live a long time. You get that kind of personal attachment to that local tree. And so obviously Dutch elm disease really just kind of slowly wiped it out, because they were quite far away from each other. It just kind of happened over a long period. So that meant that the timber that we use on, I don't know, it was about 75% of the furniture we use had just gone. And we had to rapidly find a new solution to it. I believe Dutch Elm's disease was more present in America at the time in the late 80s, early 90s. It being such a much bigger country and much bigger space, there was enough quality over there. So we then moved to get American Elm and used that for about the next 10 to 15 years until the early 2000s.
Do you use elm? I mean, is there elm now?
Well, no, because I mean, then in the late 2000s, Dutch Elm's disease really kind of reduced our supply over there. And we had to move again. We moved back over to Europe, but that was only for a couple of years, 5 to 10 years. And then that supply went as well. We really tried as hard as we could to keep to the traditional timber that we've been making furniture, that people have been making furniture in Wickham for, you know, hundreds of years. But they got to the point where it was detrimental to our furniture and our business. And we had to change. And we had done that with some collections before that we'd moved all to ash. So we have a long-standing collection called the Windsor Collection, which is all cabinets.
Which we will talk about, I imagine, at some point in the next hour.
Yeah. And so that we changed to ash in, I think it was 2012. And then when it was still part of the Urquhart Collection, the originals, which were designed by Lucien Urquhart in the 1950s, they were the last pieces that stayed into about 2017 and then finally got rid of and beech.
Can we talk about ash in that case as well? Because it's quite an underrated wood, I think. There's a whole book about, you know, what you can do with ash by Rob Penn, who's been on this podcast, actually. Why did you decide to use ash and what are its qualities?
I felt ash was a beautiful timber, really. It doesn't quite have the wildness that we saw with elm, but it's a different style. For me, I felt there was a gentle sereneness to the timber when you look at it. It really fitted with, if I look at like the light curves of like the Love Seat or one of our kind of light pieces, for me especially, it was just very natural that we went for ash. I really didn't see our pieces as oak. The timbers that we'd look at would be ash and oak, really. We got rid of beech and elm. And we do use walnut in our El Urquhart collection. It was a very simple choice, and it just felt like the right thing to do, especially as while we weren't getting British ash, we did know that there was quite a bit of ash in Britain. So potentially in the future, like we're talking now, it would have been a good timber to move to.
The other significant thing that's happened recently, and I think you just alluded to it a moment ago, is the launch of this new brand, El Urquhart. Is that how I pronounce it?
El Urquhart. It's a bit of a mouthful.
It seems to be. It contains Urquhart's classic pieces, but also work from designers such as Norm Architects, Matthew Hilton, and Tomoko Izumi. So what's the thinking behind that?
Yeah, it's a bit of a long journey.
It's another journey.
Yeah. It's more of my personal journey, I suppose. I came into the business about 11, 12 years ago now. And I suppose I was inspired by what my great uncles did back in the 60s and 70s and made us quite an exporting company. We exported around the world. About 30% of our business back then was outside of the UK. And we had really kind of, over the 90s and 2000s, kind of stopped doing that. And I felt that was a shame. Knowing what the kind of classic designs, when I came in 11 years ago, it was mainly just the originals, which were designed by Lucien Urquhart from the 50s. We had a couple of modern pieces as well, like the Treviso desk with Matthew Hilton. And I just felt it was such a shame that we weren't working outside of the UK. So my personal crusade within the business was to take us initially to the Benelux, and then it grew into Europe, then over to America, and little bits in Australia, Japan. So I was doing that with Urquhart, with, you know, the Urquhart brand, but with a different selection of product. It then grew into a different catalog, a different kind of style and look, because Urquhart is just a very different beast in the UK. We're so well established. We have such a big retail market that what I was trying to do internationally, which was talk more to a design-led customer base, the architects, interior designers, and the kind of the more high-end retail stores, because that's effectively where the initial business was going to be. There was a point where we just had to do something because the international business had grown and we were now selling it more in the UK as well. But we were also working with some of our partners with the Urquhart brand, and it just didn't work. So we realized what we called the international collection had to be rebranded. And that's really where we decided to step it away and have a new creative freedom with El Urquhart. And I've worked with Christian Moller Anderson over in Copenhagen, who used to work with Norm Architects and is our art director effectively. And we built out a kind of a brand identity, but also the reasons why we wanted to do this brand. And how it was kind of centered around the classic designs that Lucien designed back in the 50s. the pure DNA of what we are, the honest designs, which were fit for purpose, well-made, but also beautiful. For me, it was really about, he was interesting back in the 50s because he was very traditional, but he was also very modern. And so he really wanted to be pushing boundaries with furniture. And obviously he did all this thing about working out how to mass produce and industrialize it with the Windsor chair, and that kind of moved out into other pieces. So to kind of pay homage to his modernity, I didn't want to make a new brand that was just solely around his archival pieces, but I wanted to be influenced by it. So we had started working with Norm Architects just before we changed the brand. And it was really about getting them and then all the other designers that we work with into our factory and really kind of understand who we are, how we make furniture, what our DNA is, you know, what the kind of the butterfly chair means to us and the stacking chair and the love seat, to design forward-thinking pieces. And there's a kind of a scale. We can't go from 1 to 100 overnight, but there was like, some pieces would be quite similar to the classic look, but some will be further away from that. And I wanted us to be 100 years looking, well, at the time we were 100 years old, we're now 103, but it was kind of looking forward, but kind of knowing what we had done in the past. And so it was always kind of looking forward with our designs and how we make furniture, but being kind of respectful to the classics. So that's why we called it Ella Kalani, because that's his name. But at the same time, the styling visually, but also in the designs of the furniture, we wanted to kind of be pushing forwards.
Yeah, I'm interested because obviously Lucien designed a lot of his own products and you've always had a strong in-house design team. But when you go outside of that, so you go to Matthew Hilton, you go to Tomoko Izumi, etc., what are you looking for in an external designer? How do you go about choosing the people you've chosen?
Choosing someone who understands who we are and gets what we're trying to do. So it's a very simple conversation and decision. We want to work with our friends and people that we have good relationships with. Just talking to Frederick from Norm the other day, you know, he's always very happy to work with us because we're a small team. There's only a few of us who really work on the Ella Kalani kind of creative side, and that we kind of make decisions and we have our factory here to kind of work through these things. So we give the designer quite a really kind of inclusive proposition that, you know, we have our factory, we have complete control over the process and everything like that. And when I'm thinking about who are the next designers to work with, it's who will fit where we want to go as a brand. So it's just picking the people who will be able to make or envisage a newer design of our kind of classics. It's just finding this sweet spot between heritage but modernity, but bringing their own language to a newer Urkel piece. But it's Ella Kalani, obviously. It's complicated. As ever, with 103 years of history and heritage behind you, there's like fine lines and then nuance that you kind of work out throughout the whole thing. It's not a clear cut. This is a new brand. This is how we're going to design. There's all this history behind you that kind of informs what we're going to do going forward.
I mean, I'm quite interested in all that, Henry, and keen to get into your background a little, if that's okay, because you took over as chair from your father last year. I think you joined the company in 2010. Was your career mapped out from you from birth? Was it inevitable you'd work in the family business?
No, not at all. My dad was great. He never expected any of us, I'm one of three, to go into the business. I think he was very happy when I told him, I think I was about 21 or two, when I said, I'm at university, at the end of the university, I would love to join the business. Though I think he probably knew that I was going to do that because I had been kind of taking part in a few trade fairs. And that's really where I kind of cemented my reason and why I wanted to do it. So when I was growing up, obviously I came into the factory and everyone knew me, and that was at the old factory. Then we changed to the new factory. As a child and a teenager, I think as a child I wanted to do it. Then as a teenager, I didn't want to do it. And when I went to university, I kind of didn't really know.
What did you study at university?
I did history.
Okay. Me too, interestingly. So you didn't do design?
No. I went to SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies. I did kind of Middle Eastern and Far Eastern history. I did lots of history courses at school. I was a historian and I found it interesting. Mm. My dad was very keen to say, do what you find interesting at university, because I think he probably thought I was going to go to work at Urkel, but this is my one job, my one career. So it's kind of get something outside of furniture and kind of do something that you really enjoy before you join the business.
That's quite sensible. I mean, when you join the company, how does that work? Is there a rite of passage? Presumably you don't go straight into the boardroom.
No.
How do you negotiate your way through the company, I wonder?
I only became a director a couple of years ago. I spent the first year on the factory floor. So I was starting at 7 in the morning. I live in North London. becoming a student to kind of working in the factory. It was really kind of learning the hard way. And I did every job on the factory floor, really learned how to make the furniture and every single process from machine shop to assembly shop, finishing in the maintenance team, the jig shop. I knew my stuff and knew what we were doing down there. I then moved up into the office. I followed every office job for a while and then became an area sales manager. I took over the maternity cover for our area sales manager in the southwest of England. So then I was driving all around from Haverford West in Wales to Bilston up in Birmingham down to Southampton over to Cornwall. Again, I was living in North London, so it was kind of traveling out there, seeing all of our retailers and just getting to know what they felt about us. And a lot of those people we'd been working with for 30, 40 years. So it's kind of understanding the kind of the retail landscape in the UK. Then I moved out and I worked for 10 months with Vicespring in Europe.
Okay.
As some high-end bed mattress manufacturer to understand what they were doing in Europe and how they approached their export sales. And then I came back and then I really started doing I was European sales manager. I started working out how to sell in Europe really. And that was over about 3 years.
Right.
And I continued on the European sales manager, international sales manager kind of. And then I think I became a director in about 2017, 2018. And then I kind of started to learn how the board worked and all that side of it. So it's been a journey of learning on the job.
Yeah, yeah.
As I said, I went to university, did history. I didn't have any design or business experience. I've done a program for leadership development at Harvard as kind of a executive MBA thing, just to try and get some kind of academic experience on that side of it. But really being here and just being part of the business for 12 years and the way that I've done it has informed everything. I just try and be a sponge and pick up everything because it's kind of using my own experience from being family and then working with all the great people that we have here to kind of work out how we take it over the next 5-10 years. I also have to remember this is probably my 8th month as being chairman, and my dad's been here at the business 50 years and he was chairman for 29 years. So it's kind of learning patience and thinking what's the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years.
Hope you're enjoying the episode. Just to let you know, the Material Matters Fair with headline sponsor lighting specialist Bert Frank is returning to the Barge House from the 20th to the 23rd of September. Once again, each of the 5 floors will be doing something slightly different, but all will be related to materials. There'll also be a talks program, some returning exhibitors, so the recycled aluminium giant Hydro will be there, as will the Wood Awards, Solid Wool, Hagen Hinderdal, Mixed Metals and Blake Joshua, for example. And there'll also be some exciting new names, such as the Tire Collective, Biomatters, Nova Vita Design, Anna Bridgewater, also known as Abalon, Plank, Goldfinger, The Wicker Story, Jarl Newman, and Regular Concrete, with others to follow. There will also be a special installation from Milan-based platform Isola. If you're interested in taking part, do drop me a line at hello@materialmatters.design. That's hello@materialmatters.design. Is it a pressure taking on a company that your great-grandfather founded? Presumably there's a balance, and you've kind of alluded to this a little bit, of keeping things the same, but also doing things slightly different. How do you find that balance?
Yeah. So, there is pressure, obviously. When you think, 103 years old, and I'm the 4th generation, and I'm the kind of the one coming on now.
Don't cock it up, would seem to be.
I know. My dad always said, that the 3rd generation is where it fails.
So he got through that.
Yeah, he was quite happy to pass it on, to get out of there and over to the 4th generation. I do have to think over the last 103 years, we've been through so many things. Obviously, COVID and Brexit and the supply chain disaster recently has been very difficult. But we've also seen my dad himself said he's seen about 3 or 4 different recessions that we've been through. And then also the whole Second World War and all sorts of things back in the early days, that if you kind of look into the history, we nearly went under many times in the 30s and 40s. So we've been through a lot, and we've always managed to weather the storm, and it's being flexible and knowing that you have to do some things. So in the early 2000s, we knew that, well, we really wanted to make UK made furniture. We had to make some outsourced furniture and go outside of the UK to survive at that time. So for me, I'm always thinking I have this kind of ideal that I want and where I want to take us over the next 10, 15, 20 years. It's not going to happen in year one or two. It's just understanding to lay the foundations, get everyone on board with where we want to go. And we all are. We all know what we want to do here. and at the same time be flexible when certain situations come up. We've had a pretty interesting last 7 months or so because we've had a massive flood here in our showroom. So we've had no showroom. We normally have a massive, wonderful showroom, and that has affected us in loads of ways. And our office has been in upheaval, and the floor is going down now. So everyone's kind of really kind of working out how we get by and move on. There's pressure, but at the same time, I know I've got a great team of directors around me. I know I'm not the expert in anything. So it's working with experts to kind of work out where we want to go as a family with the business.
Mm. I was reading the history of the company. You sent me a book by Leslie Jackson, the design historian, recently. And the founder of the company, Lucien, he was quite an extraordinary character, an Italian immigrant. The family left Italy after they converted to Protestantism, which I thought was really interesting. He arrived in Islington before moving to Walthamstow. He was 10 years old and couldn't understand any English when he arrived. How did the family get into furniture in the first instance?
Yeah, it was actually evangelical Protestantism. So they really had to leave the country. They came over with the Samaritans and then rehoused in Walthamstow. Lucien was quite a character, but I almost think, though I know less about him, his father, Abdon,
right,
was even more of a character.
Well, he must have been. I mean, it's a hell of a step,
yeah,
to convert to evangelical Protestantism from being Catholic in Italy.
And there was eloping and there was lots of other stuff happening in there. But he was a picture frame maker for the Uffizi Gallery in Florence.
Right.
So he made these beautiful tortoiseshell picture frames, obviously very much at the time. And so he had that skill and that idea of craftsmanship. And then when they came over in the 1890s, they were quite heavily involved in the Salvation Army. And I believe it was Lucien who first started the furniture because he was the oldest son. There was four sons. But they all had some hand in furniture, the four of them. And he was doing some carpentry for the Salvation Army. And then that kind of grew. And then he wanted to do night school. And he did that at the Shoreditch Technical Institute. And that kind of grew. That was kind of designing. And that's where his kind of love came through. So I think he was probably definitely influenced by his father, who was a picture frame maker. But then by the first job that he basically had as probably a young teenager, I think it was, what was carpentry. And that's kind of where he then kind of grew that love.
Yeah, interesting. Because he started as a furniture designer at Frederick Parker & Sons in High Wycombe. Then worked for Ted and Frank Gom, who became G-Plan, before setting up on his own in 1920 as Furniture Industries Limited. What kind of furniture was he making in 1920?
Very much of the era.
Yeah.
It was a dark wood, ornate. I've got one of the early kind of rattan-sided, hand-carved legs. I think he felt it was the furniture of the time. I know from reading kind of his books and various words, it was a start for him. I think he had so many things going on with setting up the business and he wanted to do the design, but he just felt like he didn't do the design properly. So I think there was a development time in the first 20 years of the business from 1920 to 1940, where there was lots of ups and downs, where he hadn't really found his feet yet, which he would find during that kind of post-war period. He started when he was 32, and I think he had quite a difficult first 10 years with his kind of financial backers, because he didn't really have any money to start it. So he had local kind of businessmen, but he really kind of worked hard. And I know that he had a very puritanical work ethic.
A Protestant work ethic, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Protestant work ethic, I should say. He was very good to his staff, but he drove them hard. He wanted everyone to be working their best.
Well, he seemed quite a contradictory character, because it appears he wasn't solely driven by profit, though obviously any company's got to make profit, that's important. But he hated waste. There was a philanthropic side, but he could also be quite hard, seemingly. I mean, he drove people. Leslie Jackson writes, his views are a curious mix of hard-nosed pragmatism, paternalism, and sensitivity. Presumably these stories of him go down the family. Is that accurate?
Yeah, totally. He was definitely that kind of contradiction in terms. He was very pro-union and making sure that his employees were paid the best in the local area and really looking after his workforce. But at the same time, he would expect you to be the best that you could be. I never met him. Obviously, he died in 1977. But I've talked to my dad about it. And all he can remember is that he was a lovely, loving grandfather, basically. But he definitely, in work mode, he was so committed to make it work. It was kind of a social enterprise. He wanted to make sure that as many people were employed in the best way possible in the area. That was one of his first kind of things that he said when he set it up in 1920, that he really wanted to make a difference to the local people. So I take that close to heart, and I want to kind of emulate that as well in 100 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
He really was ahead of his time in many kind of employee and work practices back then. So it's nice to know that for me.
Yeah. And where did his design influences come from? A trip to the US in 1923, where he saw Shaker furniture for the first time, seems to be quite important. And obviously that continues the Protestant religious thread that we've been talking about.
Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting one. The trip to New York, it really kind of opened his eyes. I feel like he was moving in that direction, because what I've read is how much he didn't like the ornateness of the stuff that they were doing
right. In
the 30s and 20s. Mm. So I know that he was trying to kind of get there. I think probably, I mean, I have no real proof, but probably when he went to New York, he saw people doing it in a certain way. So the Windsor chair, and I've talked to my dad about this, but the Windsor chair, obviously that design has been around for centuries.
Yes.
So I think it was kind of the marriage of both of that. It's understanding how people have been making the Windsor chair and then seeing what the Shaker kind of influence was on him. And at the same time, knowing about the pressing need for industrialization. When you look at the kind of the classic Windsor chairs from the 1800s or so, they're ornate. They're completely not machinable and mass machinable. So he really was kind of working out how you kind of distill the kind of the simplest form of the design.
You should probably just, for listeners, explain who the Shakers were, actually, because people may not know. I mean, they were a religious sect, I guess we call, set up in 1774 by Anne Lee. They're a kind of offshoot of the Quakers. And they created furniture as a way of worshipping the Lord, fundamentally. Incredibly inventive. They invented the clothespin, amongst other things. But they believed in celibacy, so inevitably kind of fizzled away.
Yeah.
But they created very simple, pared-down, beautiful furniture. Lucien had a kind of, I mean, he talked about furniture as a kind of religious experience in your book. He said, I learned that there was something religious about a craft which has a bearing on people's happiness. I'm sure that when a new piece of furniture enters a house, if it is a well-made piece of furniture, as it should be, it is greeted all by all with happiness. So there is this kind of really interesting religious thing going on through your company.
Yeah, I mean, I think he really kind of lost the religious side during the 30s and 40s and more became religious about furniture.
Yeah, okay.
That's the nice. Zealousness of well-made furniture. I know anecdotally from my family that he wasn't very religious in his later years. But I think those elements that he pulled out of that initial early period from the 20s and 30s, he just used in looking at furniture, making well-made things for people's benefits. It was less about religion, more about the people and how you can make furniture that works well for the most amount of people, really.
Because as we said, it wasn't really until after the Second World War that the company we know today began to emerge with the 4A Windsor kitchen chair. And it's fascinating that it came out of this era of constraint. It was part of the utility scheme, which encouraged or indeed told manufacturers to create simply constructed and economical furniture as part of the post-war reconstruction. I mean, during the war, you made tent pegs, Urquhart. You made 36 million tent pegs, which is remarkable. And this need for efficiency and constraint, I find constantly fascinating. I mean, it's really the Mini, for example, came out of the Suez Crisis 56. But 58 was when you became called Urquhart.
Yeah, it's a bit of a grey area.
Okay.
I know the Urquhart brand was in the late 40s and 50s. But so we weren't requisitioned during the Second World War. So we had complete control over our factory. And we made tent pegs, ammunition boxes and various other things. So all of our production was for the war effort. But I think I said previously, he really knew that post-war there was going to be a massive boom for furniture. We spent a lot of time, because we could kind of invest in our machinery, invest in new kind of processes and new ways of making furniture. And that was really where we changed how we was as a business. So the utility furniture movement was talking about scarcity of timber. So it's how do you make a chair that works for everyone, but is, you're using the least amount of furniture possible.
And is inexpensive or affordable?
It was very affordable. I can't remember the exact price, about 10 shillings or so, but it was an extremely affordable chair. Obviously, we didn't make any money on it. We just kind of committed to the war effort and made it as cheaply as we could to ensure that we hit the price that was required of us. But we made 100,000 of them. And having a project like that is so big that that just sets the tone for everything to come. So the 4A kitchen chair, I see them today in flats around London. I see them in my friend's flats. It's amazing to see that chair is still around. so many years after we first made them. It was a cheap and you know, we made it well, but it wasn't meant to last that long. So it's great to see it's always around.
I think it's important to point out as well that there are lots of people there who didn't think the process could be industrialized.
Yeah.
A lot of the local bodgers were very cynical about your attempts.
Yeah. The factory pre-war was always called Erky's Folly, which was because all the local people in New Wickham didn't really understand what he was doing with trying to mass produce furniture. Why was this factory like this? And why are you employing so many hundreds of people to make furniture? He really kind of proved them wrong at that time and showed what was possible. And obviously, Wickham grew into I think there's about 100,000 people making furniture in the 60s and 70s at its peak.
Where is Wickham at now?
Now there's hardly anyone. 10, 15 bigger companies. There's probably smaller workshops. I normally say there's less than 1,000 people working in the industry in the area. From a peak of 100,000, it's huge. I think when we were next to G-Plan, so our factories were opposite back in Wickham, there was about 3,000 people employed between the two factories. It was a huge industry that's now completely gone from Wickham. And finding skilled employees in the Wickham area, there's hardly anyone. Because it's been so long since they all left that most of the skilled workforce is now retired out of the workforce. So as a manufacturer now trying to grow its UK production, we're now looking to apprentices to grow that because there's just no one who is a skilled craftsman in the area.
There's a skill shortage. Yeah. Apprentices easy to find?
We put a lot of work and effort into it. We get about 5 to 6, potentially 7 every year now. And we have done that for the last 2 to 3 years. We have about 80 people on the factory floor. I would say probably 60 of them are apprentices or have been apprentices about 40 years ago or so. Most people have come through as apprentices, but we've also, with the demise of other local companies, we've taken on more kind of skilled craftsmen who've been in the local area that we've been able to. And I really want to focus on apprentices over the next few years because it's so important for us. We want to grow our production here and we need to have the skilled craftsmen. So we'll put the time and effort in finding them. And it is about a year-long process to get most, a single apprentice on board and then train them for the 3 years and, look to keep them and keep them busy with interesting roles kind of after that.
I'm intrigued, actually, by how the factory's changed over the years because Erkel's, as you said, has always had this relationship with craftsmanship. And I wonder now, with changes of technology, what the relationship between the machine and the worker is. I mean, there's a lovely quote from Cabinet Maker in 1958 that says there's a constant striving for improvement in design and determination that it is not the machine that will dictate the design, but the design that governs the machine. It's quite William Morris. But is that still the case?
Back in the 60s and 70s, we had about 800 people working in the business. Nowadays, as I said, we have about 80 on the factory floor, about 130 is the whole business. And our turnover is probably, in real terms, probably halved. So the introduction of high-tech machinery, CNCs from the 80s, we were quite technologically advanced back in the 80s.
I know you had a CNC in 82 or something I was reading, which is seems quite advanced, but yeah.
We'd always been trying to do that.
Yeah.
And in the last 5 to 10 years, we had updated in the 90s, actually when we moved here in early 2000, and then we've updated again in the last 5 years. We've always tried to have the most high-tech machinery that we can make accurate, efficient parts, basically, because that will then mean if we have a great skill in the machine shop, it means that we can put a lot of love and effort into the assembly, the craftsmanship side in the assembly shop. They're really distinct roles for us is the machinist role and the assembly role, the craftsman role, because they're both integral to what we do. If we can't have a very productive machine shop, we can't then make furniture to the best way that we can. They're very much linked. So when we're designing furniture, we are now working out what are the new capabilities of these new 5-axis machines are. So it's almost trying to find new ways, new kind of processes that you can do in design that our machines will now allow us to do. And whenever I give people a factory tour, whenever I show them downstairs, it's really impressing on the machine shop just how efficient it is because we want to spend more time in the assembly, in the craft.
Which is where the craftsmanship is. Yeah, interesting. I slightly digressed because I was intrigued, but just going back to the company's roots.
Yep.
I mean, despite the fact that your great-grandfather was Italian immigrant, there's something very English about Erkel, isn't there?
Yeah, we are definitely an English furniture company with a Italian founder, and he was very much, we mentioned it before, he was very Anglified. He really wanted to come over and make a good British business in Wickham. I mean, he was called Luciano, but his son was called Lucien. I mean, there was all these little things where when he came over, he really wanted to embrace being a great Italian immigrant in Britain. And so we hold that close. I suppose making a new brand called Air Lercolani confuses people again. but I'm trying to get a kind of a global feel with what we're doing, but at the same time, really being proud of our British manufacturing.
Yeah, yeah. But in that English way, the company, it seems to me, and it's mentioned in your history, it has a kind of ambivalent relationship with modernism, with a capital M. Mm. Your great-grandfather, he wasn't really a modernist, was he? And there's a sense occasionally that the company has struggled to be accepted by the design cognoscenti. None of Urquhart's designs ever received a Council of Industrial Design Award, for instance. Do you have that ambivalent relationship with modernism, I wonder? Or do you recognise that?
I mean, it's interesting. I think we're a little bit belligerent. We're just doing what we want to do. And we believe in the furniture that we're making and how we're making. Mm. And yeah, there's loads of things going on. And there's lots of other designs and lots of other people doing things and movements and all that side of it. But we just want to make nice, well-made furniture. And there's a certain style to how we've kind of perfected over the years. And it's kind of trying to take ourselves out of trends and movements and just being timeless with our design. And sure, we've always got lumped in with mid-century design, with the revival in the last 15, 20 years. Well, we've been making the furniture since the 50s. A few of them have come.
Yeah, you used to have the old colonial range. It's kind of dark stained oak, 17th century inspired English furniture, which seems a world away. It's quite curious. It seems a world away from the Windsor range.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So on that side of things, we weren't afraid to mix it up a little bit. And I know we had a pine, we had a pine range. We had very dark wood furniture. It was just, as I said earlier, being flexible.
Yeah.
You know, we have a core that we are with the kind of the classic designs, with the tenets of honest, fit for purpose, well made. Over the years, to survive, we've had to go in certain ways. So back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, we had the old colonial, and that kind of moved into mural, which were very kind of, I would call them highly wrought, dark wood. Yeah, dark wood kind of pieces. We had, you know, all sorts of various different upholstery. I mean, if you look into the archives, we've had a huge amount of different types of furniture throughout the years. But there are things that have stuck. And the things that have stuck over the last 80 years are something like the Windsor Collection, which is dovetail joints. It's the same cabinets that we made in the 50s that we're still making now. And they were, you know, still in our top five of all the collections that we do. It's just amazing kind of longevity to that design. Mm.
But has that design had to make, have there been concessions to fashion along the way with those kind of collections, I wonder? There's kind of different colours at certain points and things, aren't there?
Yeah, we have a finish called Light,
right,
which is this kind of orange colour that has been the same since a very long time, basically. It kind of merged with like the kind of the traditional finish that we were doing in the 50s and 60s, which was the natural tint finish. We then in the 70s, we just called it Light, and it's basically the same finish that's been going all throughout. But obviously with something like the Windsor, we did change it to ash because we had to. So that was a major thing. Obviously we've got a kind of a range of colors and stains that we have, and there's some evergreens like black and white that will always be around. But you know, we have kind of trend colors that we come in and out, trend fabrics that we have on various pieces as well on the upholstery. So we're quite commercial in the Urquhart collection. With Air Lercolani, I have a bit of more of the option to really kind of be completely, this is us and this is our principle and this is how we want to do it. So I'm a little bit more kind of hard-edged on any decision that we are with that, because I see it as the kind of the truest DNA of what my great-grandfather did.
Okay.
And what I would like to do there. Yeah. At the same time, Urquhart is 90% of our business. So it's very important for us to keep on kind of innovating and finding new ways that we can sell our furniture that way.
Yeah. I mean, our time is nearly up, Henry. Thank you so much. Final question. You've alluded to a 10 or 15 year plan. Where would you like your two brands to be in 10 or 15 years?
Well, with Urquhart, I want us to still be relevant and still be kind of making more of what we're doing. So I haven't mentioned, but we're doing an insourcing program where a lot of the pieces that we have made abroad, we're now bringing them back into our factory.
Right.
And it's a long process, but I'm hopeful that we can build more and more of that back into it.
Where else do you make?
So with Urquhart, it's some of it's made in upholstery in Poland.
Right.
And then other pieces in Turkey and China.
So that's going to come eventually back to the UK.
Yeah, and we've already started doing that with quite a few of our chairs, and I'm hoping that we can do more prices, bring more back. I'd also hope with Urquhart that we can move slightly further afield and look at other markets outside of the UK. That will take a bit of time to get there. And then with Air Lercolani, we just want to build on what we've done. because it's a new brand and it's getting exposure and getting people to realize in England and Britain what El Urkelani is compared to Urkel. Most people know Urkel in some way or kind of recognize it, and it's just kind of moving the people who like that side of it over to El Urkelani. And from a design point, I hope to kind of be working with newer designers, British designers and foreign designers, and really kind of building out a collection that I think is warm. It's minimalist in a style, but it's also very us and true to kind of our three principles of honest, fit for purpose, and well-made. And it's bringing that kind of circle back to how my great-grandfather did it in the 50s and where I want us to be kind of looking at how we approach furniture and how we make furniture and how we design furniture.
Honest, fit for purpose, and well-made is a lovely way to leave it. Henry, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciated it.
Thank you very much, Grant. Thanks for having me.
To find out more about Henry and Urkel, go to urkel.com as well as lurkelani.com. My thanks go to the series and fair headline sponsor, the brilliant lighting specialist, Bert Frank. You can find out more about them at bertfrank.co.uk. As ever, there are images from the interviews on my Instagram page, materialmatters.design. You can find all the podcasts that I've done, sign up to our newsletter, and lots of other stuff at materialmatters.design. Finally, this is really important too. If you've enjoyed listening and want to see this podcast flourish, then please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this from. And it would make me incredibly happy if you went to my Patreon page and made a pledge at patreon.com/materialmatters. For as little as £2.50 a month, you can receive exclusive posts, blogs, and thoughts from yours truly, as well as getting access to each episode before it's published to the wider world. Material Matters is a completely independent concern, and any help you can offer would be hugely appreciated. Ultimately, you'll be helping to take the message, the importance of materials, skill, craft, and design to a whole new audience. Thanks very much for listening.